Welcome to the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber. We have here the podcast that talks about cricket. Cricket? I said my name wrong on the... what podcast was that on? Oh, on the Follow Me on India show. I couldn't say my own name. There is a certain point when you've been doing overnights for four nights in a row and it's raining, where you are just staring at parts of your lounge room overnight, and then you get up and you split your sleep into two different cycles and everything. It doesn't work. Anyway, I'm going to be Jared Kimber. I'm going to be answering your questions on cricket. Worth remembering that you can get your questions early by our Patreon. So that is Good Areas Podcast. It's patreon.com/Good Areas Podcast. And if you happen to be on this live, you can also ask super chats here on YouTube. I don't know if I'll be able to get to regular comments today, just because I'm not sure I'm alive or awake. I'm not sure what state I'm currently in. But Connor has asked a question on Patreon where he says, after a breakout 2024, where do you think Will O'Rourke stands in the global list of bowlers I do not want to face amongst top batters? Not sure what happened the last few weeks, but he's gone from lumbering around with slumped shoulders as if apologetic for his size to popping length balls into Joe Root's stick at 95 miles an hour. I thought in Sri Lanka that was the bowler we were seeing, Connor. I think the only issue there was no point in bowling at top pace consistently. But I thought he was someone trying to hit the pitch really hard at that stage. We then saw him go to India and bowl some spells like that again. So I probably was ahead of you on this curve. I know myself and Steve Harmison, when we were commentating on him bowling, we both thought he could bowl a little bit quicker than he was bowling. So we couldn't tell if that was just bowling in Asia and having it slowed down a little bit, or trying to be slightly bowl within yourself so that you can bowl the ball in the right area. But I think he's just working out what he is. What's the line in, is it Jurassic World? I think, you don't want this dinosaur to work out where it fits in the food chain. There's an element of this. I think Mornay Morkel struggled with this in his career, of the other... You talk about top batters around the world. Mornay Morkel was probably, right at the start of my career, one of the first time that, you know, I was working in cricket and talking to people. And I remember talking randomly to two cricketers from Australia, and they both referred to him as the monster. And I think the second one was David Hussey, actually. I think it was David Hussey. And I remember asking him, I said, so what do you mean by that? And he said, it's just, you don't get bowlers of that height who bowl at that pace. And it's that combination. And, you know, you could put Steve Harmison on that list. That's why Steve Harmison was so interested in Will O'Rourke, because, you know, he saw shades of himself in that bowling as well. And it really is the combination of those two things. Once you are fast and you are tall, you are an absolute menace for every top batter in the world, because most tall bowlers aren't that fast. Generally, they float the ball up more than anything else. And it's to do with, you know, the height that they release from. And also, it's very hard to be very fast when, it's actually much easier to be fast if you're shorter. You know, there are all these different parts of it. But most fast bowlers generally put the ball on the spot and use their bounce. When you get someone who can come in and just absolutely, you know, bowl at that kind of speed, there's a huge difference there. So I think that might be a part of it. Also, once you see people jumping around, he might also have been that he feels comfortable and he knows that he's not about to get dropped, that we're seeing him just push himself a little bit more with pace and understand that he will be slightly less accurate. MF Jim says, do you think the hero worship of Shane Warne is getting a bit too much? It seems every segment from Fox features something deifying him, and it's becoming quite morose. I get that he was an all-time great cricketer, but also an all-time great flog. I haven't noticed it as much. There is an element of, like, everything comes back to Warnie being a legend, I suppose, but not. I don't think I've noticed it enough that it bothered me. Look, Shane Warne wasn't always the most popular person within Australia, so it's an interesting one. There are a lot of people that sort of grew tired of him. He's part of the all-time worst Channel 9 cricket commentary said, isn't he? The whole what you should have on your pizza segment that Jeff Lemon, I don't know if he opens his famous Channel 9 piece with it, but it's certainly in there. It's kind of, you know, Channel 9's jumping the shark moment, isn't it? Like, that's the moment of which, like, I think people like me had been complaining for a while, but that was the moment that everyone just went, it's not even entertainment. It's not even cricket commentary anymore. It's just guys without really strong production from, saying whatever they want and getting away with it, which is not how Channel 9 started. You know, having talked to people like Ian Chappell, like, they were really produced back in the day. That was a terrible segment. Here's why that was a terrible segment. Don't do that again. This was a great segment. Do more of this. This is what we like. And Channel 9 sort of fell apart. So there are plenty of people. There was obviously, he did his own chat show, which is, I don't know how many episodes went live. Was it one? Like, there's plenty of stuff about Shane Warne that wasn't popular during his time, the mural. But what you are getting is that Fox really lent in on the Shane Warne is a legend personality. And he's passed away quite unexpected and quite earlier than everyone would have expected. And so I think all those things sort of play a part in that. How legacies work and everything, it's quite interesting. We did this thing on with Dan Liebke, which you can go listen to that podcast. I think it's really interesting because essentially we were talking about why the Allan Border is the Allan Border medal. And a lot of it is to do with Shane Warne, weirdly enough. But 5 years later, and it wouldn't have been the Allan Border medal. It probably would have been the Steve Waugh medal, right? 10 years later, and it definitely wouldn't have been the Allan Border medal. So you have a situation where Allan Border has two really important things named after him, Border Gavaskar Trophy and the Allan Border medal. Allan Border's a great bat, but I'm not sure he was a better bat than Ricky Ponting or Greg Chappell. Like, I think he's in that level, about the same as those guys. Played in probably a tougher era than those guys did a little bit. Although Greg Chappell played in a tough era, but didn't always play in it because of his World Series cricket, which is probably when he was at his peak as well. So either way, all the three of those guys are very good. But the captaincy, and to a certain generation, Allan Border was incredibly important. But then that straight afterwards, Steve Waugh sort of takes over that role. And then Ricky Ponting takes over as the great batter. But a lot of things are named after Allan Border. And so sometimes when you come through and everything else plays a big part, I think that sort of Shane Warne is not just a great Australian cricketer. He was an absolute celebrity all around Australia. And so he's probably the last of their free-to-air Australian cricketers. So it's not to say that we don't get free-to-air cricket on Australia anymore. Obviously, Channel 7 does a little bit of work and everything else. But Warne was literally the last person, when you look at Test cricket and then also Channel 10, of being free-to-air and being Shane Warne. And when you're that famous and you're on free-to-air. So I think it's probably a callback because right place, right time as much as anything. Whereas, Steve Smith, a lot of Steve Smith's career has probably not been on free-to-air cricket as much. And he's not like a personality like Shane Warne is, right? Like, he just isn't. He's an interesting dude, but he's not like box office in that same way. And so I think it's probably an easy thing to go back to with Shane Warne. But I don't know. I don't work for Fox. I'm very unlikely to ever work for Fox. I don't know who their producers are these days, but certainly the original producers, when they came through, weren't going to be hiring me from Fox. And so I can't tell you, but yeah, it does feel like sometimes people just become sort of a cultural touchstone, if that makes sense. And it's easier just to keep going back to that same person than it is to, remember everyone else. But, he's a very famous person. Rudra says, if Bhuvie had stayed fit enough for tests after 2018, when he played his last, ending it with 63 wickets from 26 in 21 tests, would he have been the greatest bowler of all time? I'm joking. Are you, though? but I can't help but feel that he would have been torn through batting lineups in the pace playing pandemic, because I can't imagine he would have struggled with picking out the wobble ball in addition to his amazing swing. Yeah, it's weird that he hasn't actually picked the wobble ball up that much in limited overs cricket. I think he can bowl it, though. So you're right. Look, I'm obviously one of Bhuvie's biggest fans and defended him over and over again. I can't see any reason why what would he bowl at 130 to 136? So that's kind of Scott Boland's pace. I would say he's as accurate as Scott Boland. He also has additional skills that he can swing the ball both ways. So when he was bowling with the Kookaburra after 2021, the lacquer would stay on it. So he would have that. I think there are heaps of bowlers that Dale Steyn, I think, is the best one, right? Of like, what would Dale Steyn have averaged with that delivery in his best? Like, I don't know how anyone would have played him, he's the real what if one. And there's someone else that I was thinking about the other day. There is another bowler who disappeared around that time. So yeah, I do think that we could have had another, you know, it would be really interesting to see some of those bowlers who just left beforehand, because they left when bowling averages were seen was through the roof, and then it all dipped. And, you know, you see that sort of Saranga Lakmal, Ishant Sharma impact and what they would have got from it, those guys. Josh says, inspired by Crick Picks 51, captains versus never captains test series. Do the never captains stand any chance? So you've got Smith, Gavaskar, Ponting, Border, War, Sobers, Flower, Imran Khan, Pollock, Benno, Cummins. Then you've got never captains, Hobbs, Hayden, Barrington, Hussey, Laxman, Ames, Hadley, Warne, Marshall, Garner, Murali. Well, Hadley, Warne, Marshall, Garner, Murali, certainly a better bowling lineup than Sobers, Imran Khan, Pollock, Benno, Cummins, isn't it? And the batting is Hobbs, Hayden, Barrington, Hussey, Laxman, Ames. Yeah, I think your batting lineup's a little bit shallow there. I know Hadley at 7 and Warne at 8 could cause some problems with the bowling lineup of the other one. But I would say the never captain's 11 is your never captain's 11 looks a little bit strong. Wait, it's Hobbs versus Smith, Hayden versus Gavaskar. Barrington at 3 compared to Ponting. Okay. Hussey compared to Border. So I think, I just think you can make a better never captain's 11 than that. Maybe I'm wrong. But Hussey and Laxman feel a little bit light at 4 and 5 there. But I like the bowling attack more. Sam says, should we pre-order The Art of Batting on Amazon now or wait for a signing link a la Overthrowing Cricket's Empire? I think you should do both, Sam. I think you should definitely do both. We will be doing a signing thing in when it comes out. So for those people who like to buy signed copies of books, and I know there's a huge percentage of those, when the book comes out, we will do a signed copy on Amazon. I'm much better at that now than I was when we'd never done it before with Overthrowing, and trying to find the right sort of delivery companies and all sorts of things was a big issue. Whereas I found some delivery companies that are quite good for the international stuff now. So I should be able to do that. I should be able to do it at a discount rate in the UK now in a way that I couldn't before. So yeah, there's a few different things. That I can do from that point of view. So if you are desperate for a signed copy, I would wait. But yeah, look, when it comes to writers, if there's a writer you like, the best time to buy their book is when it's on pre-order, because that helps with the algorithms and everything else. We haven't had a huge push towards it because obviously we've got Overthrowing coming out shortly and everything else. Overthrow just came out. But yeah, if you love an author, pre-ordering their book is definitely the best way to go. All right. The man who hosts Freaky Cricket has just come in my office, so clearly wants to talk to me. So I'll take a bit of an early ad break, and then you're not on the camera, mate. I can just tell. I'll take an early ad break here, and then we'll come straight back with more of the questions from Patreon. A few years ago, I realized that trying to find the best stories in cricket was impossible for any fan. I even tried to get funding to make my own cricket Huffington Post. It never quite worked. But luckily, we finally have someone filling this massive void in our game, Best of Cricket. They scour the publications everywhere to find, quite simply, all the best news and the greatest stories on our sport. Then they make it just as easy. They either email it or WhatsApp it direct to you. Cricket's greatest tales delivered to your device. This is truly the best of cricket. All right, welcome back. Got rid of Ezekiel. All right, MF Jim says, when it comes to the length of test time, how about we listen to people who have played four-day tests? They seem to be against it, saying it's far too easy to make a draw out of the game. Or is that expecting too much respect for women's cricketers? Oh, I wouldn't look at women's cricket as a good one. It's just a completely different sport. Like, they don't play enough. They don't play first-class cricket. Like, I wouldn't be talking to women's test cricketers about their sport and comparing it to the men's one. It's very, very different. I think the women would like to play five-day test as well. I don't think if you ever talk to a cricketer in the history of the game, you don't actually find that many players who don't want to play longer. So in the era when English players played 3 days, they were complaining that they wanted to play four. Like most people want to play the longer version. I remember talking to a bunch of players from the early 2000s who were like, oh, we should have played 6-day tests. Like generally that's the case. if we were to play four-day tests in men's cricket, it would be set up very differently than the women's as well, because we would have extra overs in it. So it wouldn't even compare overs for overs in that setup. Cam says, has Ben Stokes reached peak shithousery? It's good, solid start. First comments around the World Test Championship, then overrates. Now he's claiming he doesn't know what ruthless means. Is he an idiot or a dickhead or all of the above? What a flog. Well, Cam's come in on all things. Look, to be fair, when it comes down to it, we've had double flog today. Very Australian areas, that word. I think when it comes down to it, Ben Stokes says what he says, and there aren't that many people around the world who do. Like, if you look at Test captains, there is an element of diplomat to the way that they talk, right? Like, they are aware of their situation. Ben Stokes isn't like that, and he never has been. And we moan and moan that a lot of players don't say what they think, and when players do say what they think, we call them a flog. So I think that's worth saying. The World Test Championship thing is just every other nation in the world has worked it out, mate. You just sound like a fucking idiot. The overrate thing, we have seen sort of Australia and England moan and moan about this. Your fans will say the same thing. Just bowl your fucking overs. Just bowl your fucking overs. Not hard. Just bowl your fucking overs. If you want to sound smart about the overrate things, and cricketers don't do this, they should say things like, let's have an overhaul of the entire game and look at why everyone is bowling slow, because that's a very fair thing to have said. It doesn't know what ruthless means. I mean, not every cricketer is going to know every word. Like, we see celebrities on various TV shows quite often not know the meanings of things. Like, but I don't know about the ruthless one, so I'm not 100% sure that he might have misheard it as well. Sometimes you don't hear a word exactly correctly, and or he could just be tired at the end of a day's play. But look, Stokes is going to be Stokes, and it's okay for you not to like him. I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing, right? But he says what he thinks, and you got to take that. There are a lot of people who do not. Jane says, another captaincy question. How different are the skill sets required to captain in limited overs cricket versus tests? Generally, I've seen Dhoni being considered a great limited overs captain, but limited test captain. And the opposite is said about Kohli. Is there any truth to this? I think it's clear that Dhoni understood limited overs cricket on a level that a few people have. But Dhoni was a great test captain. As someone who covered a lot of his captaincy career, Dhoni was clearly a great test captain. What was the difference? His team wasn't as good. And you see that a lot, right? Oh, he doesn't captain as well in this other format. His team's not as good in this other format. During his time, he didn't have, this great barnstorming bowling attack. If he had a great barnstorming bowling attack, are we saying that Dhoni wouldn't have known how to use them? Dhoni carried Jadeja when Jadeja was literally just like a bowling automaton. He carried Ishan Sharma because they just didn't have any other options, and still made them into a decent team. What would he have done with Bumrah, Ashwin, Jadeja, all at their peaks, right? With Shami, a fully fit Shami, Muhammad Siraj coming through, Hardik Pandya being able to bowl for him, and all this. That's generally what happens, is people focus on that. Whereas Kohli captained probably as that bowling lineup was starting to assemble really well. Umesh Yadav, Ishan Sharma, who's the third bowler in that I've forgotten. Shami was starting to get fit at that point. You look like a better captain if you have a better bowling lineup. My eternal question has always been the same. And someone please prove to me that Heath Streak was a worse test captain than Steve Waugh. We look at your players and we judge you that way. And just to go to the general thing, of course you can be better as a limited overs captain than as a test captain, or vice versa. How many people are going step by step through that and not just looking at the teams that the two players have and you scramble? This team's really good and this team's not as good, so therefore he must be good at this and not good at this. But yes, you can be good at different things in captaincy the same way that you can be as a player. The kind of captain you are may not be suited to limited overs cricket, right? But yeah, generally that probably isn't why they're saying it, Jane, would be my guess. Person McPherson Face says, when did they first start playing music during cricket matches? I heard, do you believe in life after love during the third England New Zealand test, and had to ask you about the history of music in cricket matches. I can't put my finger on it, but some of the music played during cricket matches are choices. I think, is it a Vish who has, he says the New Zealand DJs go the hardest. I wonder if this isn't a Kerry Packer thing. And we don't see this in World Series cricket. Might be the first time. My guess is the Come On Aussie, Come On would have been played at that point. I can't imagine before 1977-78 that we would have had music played in Test venues. Obviously, we've had bands in the ground. So, you know, Sri Lanka and India, I suppose, would be like people drums and stuff, I would have thought. I don't know how far that goes back, but obviously you're talking more about the PA music, I would assume here. So yeah, the history of it, I would assume it comes in the 70s. It seems to become a pretty big deal in the 90s. In, I want to say, Australia and New Zealand seem to pick it up, and then other nations seem to go for it. It's obviously a limited overs thing rather than a test thing, and then eventually becomes both. It kind of makes sense to play music. There are some grounds where they just play it too loud. You know, one of NBA beat writers' biggest complaints is the loudness that that the music is played between the breaks. In fact, I think the NBA has fined sides for having their music too loud. And there's a couple of cricket grounds where I've been at and I've been like, I think the Gabba might actually be one. I'm just like, I can't, like, this is way too loud. Like, what do you think is happening here, everyone? So yeah, so there's certainly an element of that. But yeah, I think by the 90s, it was starting to happen more. So we had walk-on music in what, early 2000s as well, where batters could pick their songs. And I want to say that was Australia only, unless South Africa did it as well. And South Africa have been quite good at that sort of stuff, and New Zealand. So Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand are kind of pioneers in a lot of that sort of soft entertainment stuff of cricket. If you go back through history, those are the three places that kind of push it a little bit more. Were numbers Australia, South Africa, or New Zealand as well, I want to say? So there's a few things like that. Jane says, How much value does a captain add to that team? Is Jane writing like a thesis on captaincy? Right now, Rohit's position in the first test is supposedly necessary since India needs a captain. The same could be said to an extent of Pope, Stokes as well. What teams would be better off just selecting their best 11 and choosing one of them to lead? I mean, that's kind of what Australia's always done, right? I don't think Australia values captaincy as much as the rest of the world does. They do generally pick their best batter to be their captain as much, or the most experienced best batter, if that makes sense, to be their captain pretty automatically. And that has worked pretty well for Australian cricket. You then miss out probably on your Jeremy Coney, Stephen Fleming type captains. And Australia has missed out on those sorts of players leading before, right? Like Darren Lehman, you know, watching Darren Lehman in Shield matches, he was much better strategically than most Australian test captains were. I think that's fairly, that felt fairly obvious to me. Cameron White was probably the best domestic captain of his era, right? But Australia would never bring him in for that. So it that depends then, Jane, on how much you value that extra strategic side of things. You know, you can be in a rough position. You know, the IPL is one of the most interesting ones for this, because you do get in situations where people who actually probably shouldn't be captaining their sides at all end up captaining, or the opposite. You pick someone who's good at captaining, but it ruins your choice of picking overseas players. It's really, really rough. I'm not sure how much captaincy changes things. I think let's say MS Dhoni in T20 cricket, I think he changes things 5%, right? I think he's that good at using his resources and the way he reads the game. I would say he's the maximum that I've seen of a player, maybe going back to other things. But then, and I'm talking strategically here, right? But then how do you rate that compared to Brendan McCullum, who changes New Zealand's entire cricket DNA? The way they played cricket was changed. That's got to be worth more than 5%. They went from a very poor team to World Test champions, right? That's all on the back of what Brendan McCullum allowed them to do. Like, them having good coaches and a good system is all fine, but someone had to change the way they thought about cricket, and that was McCullum. That's got to be worth more than 5%, doesn't it? Whereas most test captains don't do that. They just come in and captain and shepherd the ship as it is. So, you know, you could wildly go, but I can't imagine it's more than 5 or 10% at absolute maximum. And most captains are probably 1% or 2% up or 1% or 2% down in the way that they, you know, lead a side, would be my guess. Grove says, how would you analyze Ganguly the batter? He averaged 41 away and 42 at home for 140-odd games. I kind of feel that the batter is not appreciated as he shared the dressing room with Sachin role. Sehwagen Laxman. How does one compare him to Rahane and Rohit, similar numbers, maybe even Virat Kohli? I think the problem with Sourav Ganguly is you need to look at his numbers quite deeply. And when you look at his numbers quite deeply, he has this baffling record. Let me see if I can find it straight away. Okay, so as you said, he averages 42 in quite a soft batting position. Like, he was coming in well after a lot of better players in very, very helpful batting position. So by the time he came in, a lot of runs were quite often scored ahead of him, right? If you look at him as a player, you talk about home versus away, but he averages 36 in South Africa, 34 in Australia, and is it New Zealand? Yeah, New Zealand, he averages 27 or something. So almost anywhere where there's lateral movement, he's got some issues overall. It doesn't dominate in Asia as much as you would expect a player like him to dominate. And in Europe, he was really good, which is quite fascinating that he didn't have any issues in England. But the thing I'm looking for, which now I've lost, is... here we go. So one thing that I really look at with top test players is kind of where they make their runs. So he played it's a fascinating record because he basically plays about a third of the time in won matches, about a third of the time in lost matches, and about a third of the time in drawn matches, right? In games that India won, he averages 46. Generally, if you're going to have an impact as a batter, you would expect that average to be way higher than that. And in lost matches, he averages 24. So that's really low. But even if you combine those, what's that? Oh my God. Let's say it's 35. 30. So he averages, I don't know, about 32, 33 in result matches, and he averages a 61 in drawn matches. So he's essentially twice the player in drawn matches. Drawn matches are usually the best pitches. So he was not a dud by any means, but he was probably slightly above average. You have to look at, match factor and everything else to have a look at it. My guess is he probably wouldn't come off very well if you looked at match factor, because the games in which he was making runs, I think a lot of people would make runs, and the games in which it was tough, I think he really struggled to make runs, would be my guess. So there's a few big gaping holes in that record. When you're comparing him to players like Rahane and Rohit, remember that they have batted in a far tougher batting era for the vast majority of their careers now, at home and away. And the home one is probably more important to them than the away one. So if we look at Ganguly, like 2000 and 2001, he averages 31 and 22 over 2 years, over 20 test matches. 2005, 2006, he averages 24 and 35. Those are years when everyone around the world is making a lot of runs, and he did not. I never thought he was a dud. I just thought that he shouldn't have been, mentioned in the same level as everyone else. But his captaincy and, played a big part in that. But he was nowhere near the level of the other great batters in his side. And as you say, that is part of the reason that he's not thought about as much now. Let us take another quick break here on Sehwagen Oil, and we will be back very shortly for more questions from the room. And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the Gabba. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox, a bit of a wild card like the general. That keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit Wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your 2x ability to chase down a big total or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a Shoaib Akhtar bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win.
All right. Welcome back to Wagon Wheel.
Panda Cyborg says, there was some recent talk on Grandstand about Carey not being vocal enough behind the stumps. A reason I also remember being mentioned why Peter Neville was dropped for Matty Wade. Why are some commentators who seem to be predominantly Australians obsessed with the idea of a chatty wicketkeeper rather than just the best person for the job? Very good question. Do you remember when they essentially picked Matthew Wade to sledge the Australians? Like, it's such a weird thing. This idea that that helps rather than someone who could average five more with the bat and is a better gloveman has always done my head in. I've played with very, very loud wicketkeepers, and I've played with wicketkeepers you never hear from. The best wicketkeeper I ever played with was a kid who went on to play top district cricket. It was probably the best natural glove I ever saw close up. Just an incredible wicketkeeper. He never said a word, partly because he was about 12 when he was playing seniors cricket. You know, we were his stop off before he went to bigger and brighter things. And the players around him just spoke more to make up for it. You do need noise out on the field. You know, Test cricket it probably needs more talk than any other form of cricket because of the amount of time that you're out there and that ability to get people going. So I think it was David Warner said recently that, like, you know, Manus Labuschagne is the voice that they try and get going in that side, because once Manus starts talking, obviously he doesn't stop. And sometimes Manus can be out in the field, and you need that voice. You need to hear from your teammates. Like, it is an important thing, and it's a very important thing, I think, within Australian cricket, where you can have long, hot days on flat pitches, right? And obviously, Australia has identified this as a culture. But I think what you're talking about, Panda Cyborg, is very similar to the whole sledging thing, which I've always found, you know, I've been writing against my whole life, which is, and I say this as an Australian cricketer who sledged, this idea that we're at our best when we sledge. No, teams sledge more when they're winning, because they're in front and there's less on the line. You know, they talk about this in the NBA, don't they? Like, anyone can trash talk when they're ahead. The players that the other trash talkers respect are the ones who do it where they're like 20 points down and they get one stop, you know. And Australian cricket's always been like that. When they're on top, they sledge more. So noise is important, but it doesn't have to just come from your wicketkeeper. It's just that, you know, there have been a lot of very vocal wicketkeepers. You know, Dick Weller of modern times would be a real example of that. Obviously, Matthew Wade was another one. But not every wicketkeeper is going to be vocal. In those situations, you need other fielders to step up and fill that void. That's the same of, like, a lot of wicketkeepers are really good with tactics, right? Very good at seeing fielding angles and saying, I don't know if this guy's hitting my gloves as hard as he was before, or, you know, or whatever that may be, right? That's a real advantage to have in a wicketkeeper. But if you have a better wicketkeeper who can't do that, you might lose something from that, but get something in a different area. And I think, yeah, it's become a bit of a nonsense thing that you just have to do that. Ellie says, from a budgetary and logistics perspective, does a 5-day contest cost the same as a 4-day contest with a reserve day for rain and weather? Does a 5-day? Yeah, it would. Yeah, I would think it would cost roughly the same, Ellie. I'm not an expert because I've never hosted these events. You might get a slight discount on it, but I wouldn't think. Once you're employing people for that fifth day, it's very hard. So as a cricket commentator, I've worked with people who'd be like, we'll pay you for how many days that the test match goes for. And I always say the same thing. Great, well, I may not be available on day 4 and 5 then, because I'm going to have to book other work. And then suddenly they're like, oh, okay, yeah, I see how that works. That's not possible. You can do that with some of your staff, some of your more casual staff, you know, people who work in, you know, maybe not the cleaning crews, but bar staff and everything. But think about a test cricket. If you want to clean it, right, a cricket ground takes a long time to clean between days. So they have these incredible, like, sweeping crews to come in, like at a concert or anything else. And they literally, almost from the bottom of the grandstand to the top of the grandstand, there will be people just like sweeping through and cleaning it up. To get that many people to be able to do that job quickly and accurately means that you probably have to have them pre-booked. And so, and that's just one job. You can't just suddenly put a message up and hope that 50 or 80 people are available to be able to do that job. If you know, as an emergency, because those people will go and probably try and work somewhere else on day 5 would be my guess. I'm just trying to work out how this would work. It's very hard to suddenly spring the few hundred people that you need who are all going to be available on day 5, who also are going to be experienced, right? Like, you know, anyone who's ever been to a stadium without that sort of stuff. So I think there would be a discount, Ali, but I don't think it's enough to make it worthwhile all the way through would be my guess. Ian says, have the PCB hit a new low with this Kirsten Nielsen Gillespie debacle in the last few months? Having bounced back from Bangladesh defeats to beat England and look quite good. This seems like another complete farce, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, the beating England was a bit of a farce because they did it in a way that was non-replicable. right? And once you do something like that, you're already in a situation where it's a bit tough. I don't know if this is a new low, though. I think if you talk to people who've worked with the PCB over the years, they'll give you quite a few lows. But it shows you that the basic things are still not being worked out. They're still very beholden to the cult of personality. They're still not making long-term decisions. They're making short-term decisions. And while those two things are true, they're still going to stuff up. Thatchbow says, would you refuse to cover a tournament if it was clearly being held to sportswash the hosting country's government? Suppose this is a football World Cup question, isn't it? No, I'm probably more likely to go there and do the opposite, which is, you know, get there and do the stories that actually tell the story. I mean, isn't all cricket in Dubai kind of sports washing? Although, to be fair, I've never actually covered a series in Dubai as a media person. So, I mean, that would be cricket's great one, right? Like, Dubai's not exactly a great place if you're not one of the elite. And they certainly have many issues over there. I think you could make that. But yeah, and also most World Cups are probably, maybe not most World Cups, but there's a lot of World Cups that have been hosted. And there's an element of sports washing every time you want to host a World Cup, isn't there? Maybe not quite on the levels that you're talking about for places like Qatar and Russia and Saudi Arabia. But it's always there, isn't it? That's why you want to host those big events. But no, I'm probably more likely to go in and try and cover the sides that they don't want you to cover is probably how I would look at it. But maybe also it depends on, there's blatant ones and there's sort of more casual ones, right? Josh says, before the current New Zealand-England series, you said Glenn Phillips is a taker of great catches, not a great catch taker. In hindsight, do you feel especially clever? I don't remember saying that, Josh. But yes, I do think that that's probably how I would rate him. And I think we do get confused with that quite a bit. You know, Ben Stokes is a very good example of when the ball goes straight to Ben Stokes, I don't feel like I'm that comfortable that he's going to take every single option. But I also know that Ben Stokes at slip can probably cover another half a body length that other players can't, and that some of those are going to stick. And so therefore he's allowing you the ability to sort of have this, catches that normally wouldn't be taken, but he's not safe. And I think this is pretty common. I've got this with ground fielders as well, Josh. I always thought that Martin Guptill was a good example of, everyone said Martin Guptill was a great fielder. Martin Guptill was an incredible mover, right? He was a much better mover in the field than Michael Clarke was. But Michael Clarke was a one-touch fielder. That ball hit his hands. He very rarely fumbled it. And then he had a very good throwing arm and was left-handed. I would say he was a better ring fielder than Martin Guptill. Martin Guptill could get to balls that Michael Clarke wouldn't even dream of getting to, right? Especially later in his career when he struggled. But Martin Guptill fumbled a lot. And I don't remember him being a great thrower either, like as an accurate stump-hitting thrower. David Warner was another player who, I felt could get to balls really easily, but fumbled a little bit and could cock up his throws quite a bit. Maybe his shoulder played a part in that as well. And so we conflate those two things quite a lot. And when we did our great fielders of all time, Mark Waugh, one of the reasons I think Mark Waugh was such a great fielder is he didn't cover as much ground as, say, Dean Jones would at cover or point. But Mark Waugh almost took the ball first take every time. He was so balanced that he could always throw, whether he was doing a backhand flick or, doing a normal throw, he was almost always balanced, which meant his throws were always near the stumps. He hit the stumps quite a bit. That, and then he had the ability that he was a great consistent catcher and also a great athletic catcher when he wanted to be. That, to me, is a great fielder. It's the combination of doing all those different things. Whereas Jonty Rhodes is the perfect example of this. Jonty Rhodes could probably cover an extra couple of meters on either side that most fielders have never been able to cover, especially compared to his era. I don't remember many times where Jonty Rhodes would take the ball cleanly and then throw down the stumps in a way that Ricky Ponting did. So are they both great fielders, or is there a difference? And I think that, a lot of the stuff that we cover on this kind of channel is me trying to understand those sort of things and explain them to fans. And I think that's probably what I was trying to do with Glenn Phillips, is say, look, I don't think Glenn Phillips, if you had him at third slip, would be a really consistent slip fielder. But I think if you had Glenn Phillips at third slip, he would take catches that normal third slips would not take. And that's kind of, I'm trying to move the conversation forward a little bit when we talk about fielding. James says, who's the best ODI player never to play a test? Inspired by thinking about how weird it was that South Africa never tried David Miller in tests. the best ODI player never to play a test. Okay. I mean, Susie Bates, James, probably is the automatic answer there. Andre Russell. Oh, but is Andre Russell like great? What was Andre Russell's ODI numbers? I think Andre Russell's the best cricketer. Oh, he played one test, didn't he? What a bastard. It's just as I said that, I was like, I think he might have played a test. Andre, let me down. So I would have to go through the list. David Miller's a really interesting one. Trying to think of anyone else. I mean, there's probably a few if you would go back through associate nations, a bit like women's cricket, right? Steve Elworthy played four tests. He wasn't a great ODI player anyway, though, was he? Or was he? Miller's a really interesting one. And it's kind of weird that they never used Miller because I think he would have been fine. Was Kyron Pollard might be another one that you would have up quite high there on that kind of a list. He definitely didn't play a test, did he? No. But his ODI numbers are not fantastic, are they? Miller's a good shout. I'd have to go through though and come up with some sort of, I can't work out how to search it right now, James, but some sort of list of the best players to have played the most. So what you're looking for really is, I wonder if you can just stats guru it. If you're looking at players who play all three formats, and then you look at someone who has played. So you'd have to take away. So reset qualifications. I'm trying to work this out if we can do it on the fly. Yeah, I don't think you can quite do it on StatsGuru. You'd need to come up with a metric that shows you the players who played the most ODIs with zero test matches. And then you'd be going through that list. Miller's a very good option there. Bloody Bugger says, on Crick Picks, you mentioned that we forget Mark Taylor was a better tactician than Ponting because Ponting's commentary is far more analytical. As a historian, what are other examples of public misremembering history due to current events? Elsewhere, you mentioned introduction of DRS makes people believe that classic batters were better at spin World War I, causing 1880 and 1914 to be the golden age. Yeah. So there's plenty of sort of those misremembering moments. I think, we've kind of forgotten public misremembering history. W.G. Grace is the best one, isn't he? W.G. Grace definitely did things on a cricket field that today would get you suspended for life. He probably fixed lower level cricket games in a day when that was fairly common, right? But again, if you did that now, it would be dodgy. W.G. Grace ran out Sammy Jones when Sammy Jones went to do some gardening down the middle of the wicket. He kidnapped a player, whatever, and yet he is considered this incredible god of English cricket. He doesn't really represent the only thing he really represents in English cricket is entitlement, right? Like, I'm not, I think he's a fantastic player. I'm not having a go at it as a player, but I mean, he doesn't represent English cricket. All the bullshit about spirit of cricket and gentlemen and everything, he wasn't any of those things. Right, he was a gentleman by name, but he wasn't a gentleman by nature. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, he's the one that is, the most misremembered. I suppose Vinu Mankad is another one that I would put pretty high on that list of, Mankad's becomes less popular over the years. There were many people defending Mankad at the time, like Brown, Bill Brown, who he ran out. Bill Brown said, "I was an idiot. I should have stayed in my crease." So those are two obvious ones. Women's cricket is the other one. Like, women's cricket made money in the 1800s. We still get people now saying, oh, no one will pay to see women's cricket. They literally paid to see it in the 1800s. It was really popular. We have these little flare-up competitions, random competitions that worked, right? We stopped women being able to play cricket as a misogynist society. We stole their money when they did play cricket, so they didn't make any money as professionals. We stopped playing it because we saw it as bad for, values. Even when women's test cricket starts, you can't be married to play it. Like, we made it almost, we didn't give them access to grounds that would have helped them get big crowds and all these sorts of other things. They had to play in the middle of nowhere. They didn't have access to the system of men's cricket that was really successful, partly on the back of a lot of women going to watch men's test cricket, right? Like, So there's another one that in professional sport is misremembered, I would say. What are some of the other ones? I think just from a really fascinating one is the West Indies quartet, which wasn't until I did my book, I realized how long it actually takes for the quartet to start being used. Because we sort of hear, they're inspired by Tomo and Lily. They start to, they bomb India and Sabina Park. But if you have a look, they still picked spinners and medium pacers and all-rounders for a while before the four fast men assemble. And that's not talked about at all anymore, that it wasn't, you know, that if Clive Lloyd is such a genius, I'm not saying he wasn't because he was, but if he's such a genius, it did take him quite a while to convince everyone else of this theory. I think the two ones that I think should be looked at more is, I know the Invincibles were incredible and were really important to Australian culture, but it was a one-off test series, right? Like if we're going, who are the best teams of all time? Would we not have the New Zealand men in it then if it was a one-off test series and they went to India when no one else could win in India and they won 3-0, right? You have to look at everything around that. Yeah. They were going into England, which was, you know, a war-ravaged country. I'm not saying Australia didn't have issues during the war, because clearly they did, but the war wasn't really majorly in Australia. They weren't being bombed by the Germans, right? Like, I know the Japanese were hanging around in ports and stuff. It's not the same, right? I think there's some element there of the Invincibles probably being overly hyped up on the back of one test series in a way that these days we just would never do, right? So I always hesitate a little bit when people say the Invincibles are one of the greatest test sides of all time. In fact, I don't even hesitate. I generally don't put them in that list, right? And then the other one is the South Africans of, you know, they played the Australians twice at home over a 3-year period. They clearly matched up really well against the Australians. I'm not saying that great pre-apartheid side wasn't incredible, because it was, and we know it was. We know what Barry Richards and Pollock continued to do, and they had a fantastic team. However, it was two series at home, and we over-index on that, partly because there's a romantic element to it. Like, that was the team that never existed, right? Forget the politics of it. It's just, we know how good some of those players were, and we never got to see them. You know, it's hard to watch Mike Proctor in county cricket and not be like, that would have been incredible in test cricket. We would love to have seen him, you know, consistently, right? You know, and Barry Richards and Pollock and the other Pollock, you know, and even people like Dennis Lindsay, the wicketkeeper, who's not particularly famous. Like, they, you know, Colin Bland, all these incredible cricketers who we never got to see. But again, it is two test series at home. So I think those are the ones that probably automatically come to my head as we are misremembering them a little bit. And Bodyline, I suppose, would be another one, wouldn't it? Of Bodyline now just looks like a good tactic that Australia didn't handle, right? And it wasn't even completely outlawed at the time. It's just that teams stopped doing it. Everyone was making runs in the 1930s. It made sense to bowl bouncers. The fields didn't make sense. They should have changed the fielding laws straight away. They didn't. They changed the fielding laws later to go up against off spinners. Dinesh says, in his conversation with R. Ashwin, Gautam Gambhir said that in a dressing room, the singular thing that makes a player feels like they belong is appreciation for their small contributions. In addition, he said that no one cares about team bonding activities or team dinners, which according to him are just PR for the social media handles. In your experience working with dressing rooms, how true or false has this been? First one, I really agree with. Second one, I massively disagree with. First one, it's true. Like, you know, it's what I try and tell people on this channel all the time, of like, why we see players like Rahane and KL Rahul and Joe Denley is the professionals quite like them. They've been through it all. They've had the shit flung at them, but they do their jobs. They're willing to take the worst roles when they have to. They play for each other. They're probably the sorts of people in the Nets who are, you know, suggesting things to each other, to players. You know, they bring other things. I remember when Mickey Arthur was coaching the Australian team and he said something along the lines of Usman Khawaja and Phil Hughes, who were both young, were very good batters. And he said that, but he said they don't bring anything else to the team. They're not great fielders. They're not great communicators at that stage. You know, Uzi was still quite young. And Phil Hughes was very much like that. Like, they didn't feel at that stage they brought a lot to the team. That's why teams generally trust players who are 26, 27, 28. It's not that the young players can't become that, but they're not that at that time. The bonding stuff, But working out a way to help teams bond is a hugely important thing. I don't think you would need to do it with the vast majority of international teams just because over a long period of time, they have worked out how to bond on their own. But doing things like making sure that, you know, senior players have breakfast with junior players is really, really important so that they don't feel like they're outsiders. I'm shocked that Gautam Gambhir hasn't noticed that because it's a really important thing. Making sure that your team is working cross-generational. This means you get so much more out of your team. Young players come in with fresh ideas. Older players can help professionalize the younger players. I can give you a list of so many players who felt like outsiders, who wouldn't have felt like outsiders if the team had understood what was happening in front of them. I would definitely say that that is very important. I think what he's probably talking about is those sorts of artificial team bonding things, which is more, going on an army camp and everything else. So I don't think that works as in like going on a trek or somewhere, particularly helps the cricket. But what it does do is it allows everyone to take the cricket out of it and meet people outside of that and understand their teammates a little bit better. That can work. You don't always have to go that extreme though, but that actually does work. And understanding who your teammate is and what they're motivated by allows you to work with them better, right? So those things really do play a part. As far as team dinners, I think team dinners are really important. You know, the two sides I would look at is San Antonio Spurs in the NBA and Netherlands. Netherlands, you have to have breakfast with the team every morning. That is part of the playing with the Dutch team. And they have this big long table. I've seen the way those guys play for each other. They all know each other. There is a bond there that I have worked with other teams that do not have that bond. And then you look at the San Antonio one where, you know, they're all having the red wine dinners or whatever they were. They're all talking about the game together in a relaxed, more casual way than you can do in the change room. There's a tension inbuilt in change rooms that is never going to go away. Allowing players to bond with each other outside of that is very important. Vivek says, Head does not seem to be that troubled against Bumrah, even though Bumrah is on a tear right now. Is that simply a matter of form, or is there something in his game that gives him some unique advantage? Look, I think even Bumrah is going to bowl slightly away from his best areas, and Head can punish anyone who does that. I don't know how many times in this series Head has faced Bumrah rested. Batting at number five is easier than batting in other positions, and one of those reasons is bowlers are generally on their second or third spell when you face them. There is a big difference between facing someone in their first spell and their second or third spell. There's a big difference between facing them in their second spell at towards the end of it, then them being rested for a long period of time, and then them coming back when you're fully set. I think there's an element of that there, Vivek, if I'm being honest. And he punishes slight mistakes, and Bumrah only ever makes slight mistakes. William says, why are there not more multi-format series across both men's and women's game, like the women's Ashes? Men's cricket just developed differently to that. Women's cricket has sort of brought it about, so there's the South Africa one at the moment, but there isn't that much multi-format women's cricket, as in all three formats. Not all the teams play test matches and everything else. I think that's probably what the future of women's game is. I think in the men's game we've just developed in a different way. So I would probably push it in women's cricket and wouldn't push it in the men's game, William. Rudra says, how skillful was Zahir Khan? Incredibly skillful. Was he truly skillful or just skillful for a lefty? Skillful for a lefty, but that is incredibly skillful. I remember him as amazing from 2007 to 11, but I never thought about how left-arm pace has a natural advantage to your podcast results when on the topic. And if you were picking an all-time three-man pace lineup for India, would you pick him, Bumrah, and Kapil Dev? Oh, I'd have Shami ahead of Zahir Khan, I think, at the moment. And Javagal Srinath is brilliant as well. I'd have to go through their records really deeply. If you follow my stuff back in the early days, I've always been a huge fan of Zahir Khan. He's going to be one of those people who's not remembered as great because his bowling average looks ordinary, but he played in the great batting era on some really great batting tracks and on tracks that didn't suit him. I thought he was an absolutely fantastic bowler. I thought, yeah, probably he is skillful for a left armer rather than overall skillful. But I remember Ed Cowan, playing in that first test series against him and Ed Cowan sort of saying, my God, I cannot believe how quickly he works you out. And that has always stuck with me. And I was already a huge fan by that point. So No, look, I was a huge fan of Zaha Khan. I've never kind of gone back to go to have a look at where he fits in. Him and Peter Siddle and Chris Martin are three bowlers that I want to go back and have a look at now that we know a lot more about the eras that people bowl in. MF Jim says, why are square leg umpires standing in line with the stumps rather than the line? Run out chance seems to be given to the third umpire. They were encouraged to do that because it's much easier to, the things that they want third umpires to look at is things like the glove, the hand going in front of the gloves, whether the wicketkeeper has hit the bales, all those sorts of things, which you need to know. You need to see on the field, whereas the third umpire can easily handle the runouts, and the square leg umpire, being a meter back, still has a pretty good idea of what's close and what's not close. So I think they're using their skills in the best way possible there, Jim. I've got no problem with that one at all. Ali says, is there a way to check if T20 franchises are profitable, at least on the path to profitability? Trying to find out which ones are strictly or partially for notorious purposes, money laundering, fixed betting. No, because they're not really public with their numbers. The best way to work it out is, has that league said that they have signed a big deal with a TV company for rights? And if they haven't, they're probably not profitable short-term or long-term, right? Like if they haven't said, we've signed a deal with Channel 10 for $20 million or, you know, Sky for an extra $5 million for this league or whatever it might be, it's probably not profitable. And so you see some of those, like there'll be a league, I can't remember the one, but there was a league not that long ago who sent out a press release that said, we have a partnership with this TV, and it didn't say anything about money at all. And I honestly believe that they'd given the rights for free to that TV company, because it's so rare to not mention the deal. Because the deal is the thing, right? If you could say, we got $20 million out of this, you can then go to sponsors and everyone else. Like, the deal is really, really important. The T20 leagues, the money laundering and the fixed betting is one thing. That's kind of the bottom end. But a lot of those leagues also exist for something called betting rights. And betting rights is like you can do a deal with major betting organizations to get money so that they have the feed really quickly. So everyone who wants to bet on it has to bet through them. So there's that. Have instant access to the footage. So you'll see if you follow cricket betting sites, you'll see sometimes you'll be on a stream that's really, really fast. They're never as fast as the illegal ones are that major betting syndicates pay for, but they can be really, really fast. And so you can pay for that. So those are the three major things. And then, of course, never underestimate there are leagues that exist because rich people want to hang out with cricketers. And there might be brands who want to be associated with cricket who cannot afford the big money. So there's about five sort of low-end ways of making money, right? That we've just mentioned. Some are illegal, like the money laundering and fixing matches. We're seeing some of these T10 leagues where you look at them and it's just like there's no reason for them to exist otherwise. So there's that. But then there are sort of other basement level things. But if you really want your league to be profitable long term, you have to be able to sell it as a package to major TV suppliers. And if you can't do that, you're probably at best treading water most of the time. All right, that is me done with the Patreon questions. I think we've got some super chats coming in and then I'll finish up. Sameet says, 80s West India made teams pivot to tall hit the deck bowlers. In the wobble ball era, would teams stop promoting pure swing bowlers like Bhuvie and Stain? Yeah, they already are, Sameet, I think. We've already started to see that. How many pure swing bowlers are there in Test cricket at the moment? Is there any? Was Southie one of the last ones? I still think there's going to be an element of... I actually think swing bowling will come back a little bit in limited overs cricket if you can swing the ball both ways. But I would say there isn't a pure swing bowler left in Test cricket. So it's kind of already happened to me. And, you know, there will be people who are being nostalgic. And the other thing is that what analytics kind of does is sometimes it can make things a little bit spammy. You know, everyone tries to hit home runs or everyone tries to throw touchdown passes or, you know, everyone shoots three pointers. And there's an element of that's what's happening in cricket. It's becoming more one-dimensional with the kind of bowlers. But then that will make someone else will come in and do something different afterwards. Sameet again says, international teams bowling reflects domestic competitions. India fast spin, Pakistan reverse swing, Australia tall, etc. England swing. What explains South Africa's varied pace attack? So South African wickets are very different in different places. You know, you have the sort of nibbling around wickets in somewhere like Cape Town. You have slower wickets in somewhere like Kabirka and East London. You then have the really bouncy wickets up on the high veld. So in order to be a good South African seam bowler, your background will do that. Whereas you compare that to Australia, every wicket has bounce. So you're going to get more tall bowlers there. Not many wickets were conventionally seamery, nippering around. You know, that's changed of recent times. So Australia didn't really pick the bowlers who seamed it and nipped it around all that much, right? Unless they were taking a sort of a Bob Massey, Terry Alderman type player to England. You didn't get as many of those kind of bowlers because you defaulted to everywhere else. Whereas South Africa has built in more variability where you need tall, fast bowlers to hit the pitch. You need just quick bowlers. You need really skillful seamers. So I think that's probably what you're looking at there. West Indies is another one that was very similar to that. You know, the wickets in the West Indies were so different that the fast bowlers probably developed in a different way. Genius says, shouldn't more sports try to create more nerds for, my God, more nerds for what, Genie? More nerds for what? You've left me hanging on this question. I'll see if you finished it. I don't think you've said anything else, so I can't see it there. Shouldn't more sports try to create more nerds? As a general rule, yes. I think I've had this conversation with a lot of people who work within cricket. They don't get that it's the hardcore people that drive a lot of this. So, you know, a lot of the cool nicknames and everything comes out of, you know, online cricket communities and hardcore fan bases, right? In a way that it never has before. A lot of the minutiae that gets obsessed with and passed around is built from that sort of the more hardcore nerd thing. And the problem with cricket boards and most sports is that they are so desperate to get more casual fans in. Casual fans are absolutely brilliant, and that's essentially where you make your money. But casual fans don't want to come into a sport where there isn't nerds explaining things and telling them what things are fascinated and showing them all these sorts of things. Like, these two things work in harmony. You know, as someone who's a big NBA fan, like, the casual side of thing is obviously where the NBA is going to make its money. But the hardcore thing is what drives the engine. They're going to go to all these matches. They're going to tell you that this incredible thing has happened. And I think that most sports have got in a position where they haven't really understood that as much as they should. I hope that answers your question. Certainly as best I could. So you guys, I was playing cricket after 9 years, 10 kilograms. Oh, StreamYard is having a moment, isn't it? I'll try and read that off the small. 10 kilograms, playing cricket after 9 years, 10 kilograms overweight, back aches, vitamin and iron deficiencies, starting with jogs and stretching. Any nets, any advice? I think, depending on how much, what kind of cricket you're playing, Sega, like what kind of cricketer you are, I think the one thing that I would always remind you is that cricket really hurts when you haven't played it for a while, because it goes for a long period of time. And because you think about it as a less strenuous sport than some other sports, a lot of people kind of throw themselves back in and, you know, play a big long inning. So for instance, almost every year I tweak a hamstring early on running between the wickets. And it's because I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to go out there and run all that fast and whatever. But then I face a good bowler. He pins me down for a couple of balls. I hit the ball to the left of, you know, mid off or mid on, and I take a single. And of course I have to then hammer it through. And in order to do that, I tweak my hamstring, right? Those sorts of skills we don't think about a lot. The big one I always see with cricketers coming back is throwing. So something as simple as, I think baseball, they call it long toss, where you start throwing the ball like 10 meters from each other, and then you just keep moving back a few meters until you get to about 50 meters and you can do those kinds of throws. Like, nice soft throws warms you up. And the same with bowling, of like bowling at half pace and almost shadow bowling for a while and moving in. I think all those things are quite important. But yeah, being that I get injured almost every year, I come back and play cricket. I may not be the best person here. But it's remembering that there are short, sharp runs and that there are really hard throws. So my biggest issue is I never warm my shoulder up correctly, and I have shoulder issues. And then I love getting run outs. So I can move quite quickly in the field. I can pick the ball up. I can get runouts. But generally, my first hard throw of the day is in a runout, and I almost throw my shoulder out every time. Sakrishna says, who are the most creative captains in world cricket, international, domestic, and who are the future most interesting captains we aren't aware of? Future most interesting captains, you never know until they're captain, so it's a really tough one. Like, you can look at players and say, oh, that is quite interesting. The way that they think about the game, and then they captain, and they captain by numbers. Who are the most creative captains in world cricket? Well, Ben Stokes, obviously, is very creative. Who else is creative? Don't think internationally I can think of that many other creative captains off the top of my head. It's very hard to be a creative captain, because I think most captains probably become more negative and more defensive as they take over, just because the job is so hard. And future captains, you're just looking at players who think about the game differently. That's kind of what I would always be looking at. So Jaiswal would be someone I'd be interested in. Travis Head would probably be a captain of Australia. I'd be fascinated to see. I don't think I saw that much of him captaining South Australia, because they were so rubbish in those days. I didn't watch a lot of their games. So he would be another interesting one. Harry Brooke obviously thinks about cricket in a very different way. Bumrah probably thinks about cricket in a very different way. So I think there's a few there. Whether they're going to be creative or not, I don't know. Samit says, why is Test cricket the purest form? Newbies play T20 instinctively. Post-podcast, we'll play cricket. Pretty sure none of us are going to auger it. Test cricket is the purest form because there is nowhere to hide over a long period of time, right? Eventually, the best cricketers generally win the most amount of a high percentage of matches in Test cricket than anywhere else. That is not the case in T20 cricket and T10 cricket, where you can have an outlier performance, can really change a game quite dramatically. And the winning percentage in T20 cricket for really successful teams is lower than ODI cricket and lower than Test cricket. So the higher you go and the more cricket you play, the more pure it is, because the results are more pure. Rahul says, why do we still need Bales? So I've done this before. Bales obviously were a very elegant thing to solve an issue. So we had a situation where it was very hard to tell what was happening within the game of cricket. Anyone who's ever played with like metal stumps or, you know, something else with stumps will know there's lots of fights over whether the ball hit the stumps or not. So we went with Bales at that point. The reason we have stayed with Bales at the moment is we would have to like pressure test the stumps to know if the ball has hit the stumps hard enough to be able to do that. We also don't always know, Roel, if the ball has hit the bat, right? So why would we put ourselves in a situation where we now don't always know if it's hit the stumps and we would be guessing? And what if you played a big expansive shot, you missed the ball, the bat creaks as the ball is going past the stumps, and then that is given out based on that. Bales essentially allow us at the moment a shortcut, and also it's a cool kind of flaw / plus that you have to knock the bales off, right? You can't just hit the stumps. I don't think it's as easy as you would think to know when someone has hit the stumps with their hands or when the ball has hit the stumps and everything else. So I think we still need Bales because we don't have the technology 100%. And it's still, I think that is still a better result than taking the bales off and just every time the ball hits the stumps, having to review it to make sure that it hit 100% on the outside of the stumps. And then having technology that we know doesn't always work for catches and caught behinds and things, then take over. I don't see that as a plus. What we might be able to do is have like a baseball situation where you have like a zone, right? I just don't think cricket is ready to make that leap at the moment, but we might see something like that in the future, and whether the ball is passed through the zone. Again, it's just for the top level of cricket. It's probably going to be very expensive. Does it improve the game? Those are the questions that you need to make. And at the moment, obviously not. That's it for the Wagon Wheel today. Thank you to all my super chatters and everyone on Patreon, as always, for supporting us. Remember, if you do support us on Patreon, you get access to our Discord and everything else. I haven't been on the Discord this week for the last test match, just because it's like something about being on a Discord at 3 a.m. after you've been awake for 3 hours that just emotionally has not worked for me at the moment. But usually you can find me if hanging out on the Discord more than pretty much any other social media. I'm Jared Kimber. This is The Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back again very, very shortly for more of this kind of thing and more of other kinds of things. Lots of things.
thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minvo.pro now.